You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday morning, February the 7th. And we'll talk this hour about the perjury trial of former vice presidential aide Lewis Scooter Libby and its implications for journalism. And what we are learning about the relationship between some Washington journalists and people in power in the Bush administration. And we'll wonder if reporters are too close to government sources. And we'll wonder what you think about this trial and the issues being raised as we talk with Dave Berkman. Haven't talked to Dave in a while. Dave, of course, a former host of Wisconsin Public Radio's Media Talk, our media pundit and sometimes political commentator. We welcome your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, toll-free from anywhere. If you're in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. The news of the day is that the prosecution plans to wrap up its case today with testimony from journalist Tim Russert. The host of NBC's Meet the Press will be asked about a phone conversation that he had with Scooter Libby in 2003. Libby says it's how he learned the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame, but Tim Russert says that they never discussed Valerie Plame. The federal prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, contends that Lewis learned about Plame's identity from other government officials, leaked it to reporters, and then made up the Russert conversation to cover it up. So what do we think about the Lewis-Libby perjury trial and the implications it has on journalists and the role of the journalist? Let me welcome Dave Berkman, who is a retired UW-Milwaukee professor of mass communications. Good morning.
Morning.
What do you make of this trial and its implications on journalism?
There are four press-related aspects to the Plame-Libby affair. Let me briefly summarize them. First, it exposes how the Bush administration will, the lengths it will go to intimidate those who publish criticism. We're talking in this case, of course, about of Valerie Plame's husband, Joe Wilson. Second, how, and somewhat conversely, how it co-opts the press to get out its message, even if that message consists of outright lies. The classic example, on a Saturday, the administration leaks Ahmed Chalabi's lies about WMDs in the lead-up to the war to the New York Times' Judith Miller. Sunday morning, Rumsfeld, Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice each make the rounds of one of the three Sunday morning talk shows, and each says, hey, if you don't believe us, look at this at the front page of this morning's New York Times. Third, it really puts into focus how the federal judiciary represses press freedom by jailing reporters who refuse to reveal sources. Remember, of the 50 states, all but one have press shield laws. And the other major exception, of course, is the federal government. Fourth, you have this situation that working journalists find particularly uncomfortable, discomforting, however you want to term it, which is finding themselves part of the story. Let me read you a very brief excerpt from something I came across the other day by on Monday by press critic Eric Bola, who I think perfectly summed this thing up. And he said, quote, in a sense, the Plame affair was Watergate in reverse. Instead of digging for the truth, lots of journalists try to bury it. The sad fact remains the press was deeply involved in the cover-up as journalists reported White House denials regarding the Plame leak, despite the fact scores of them received the leak and knew the White House was spreading rampant misinformation about an unfolding criminal case. And that's why the Plame investigation then and the Libby perjury trial now so perfectly capture what went wrong with the timorous press corps during the Bush years as it routinely walked away from its responsibility of holding people in power accountable and ferreting out the facts.
So, Dave, why, though, would journalists actively try to cover this up? This would be a good scoop, wouldn't it?
Fear. Fear of bringing down the wrath of the administration. Fear of having their patriotism questioned. Mm-hmm. Remember, by the time you're at the summer of, what was it, summer of 03, for a year and a half, we had been told by the administration, and this was directed especially at the press, you're either with us mm-hmm. or against us, and if you're against us, you're one with the terrorists.
Yeah.
We have this famous instance of Judith Boomiller, who was the White House correspondent for the New York Times about a year ago, addressing some group, maybe in a Columbia Journalism School, saying we blew it, we were afraid, we acted as cheerleaders, we didn't dare question the president. I mean, these things were not secrets. As Maureen Dowd wrote last, it was on Saturday, hey, I knew that all of this was lies. Where was the rest of the press corps, including the New York Times?
Yeah, I suppose they are looking at your number one point here, that they saw what lengths the Bush administration would go to punish critics.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, if journalists in a free society don't cave in like old Soviet journalists did back in the Stalinist era.
Yeah. The whole thing about leaking, the way the administration was leaking information, especially to Judith Miller, aren't government sources and this kind of leaking, this has been going on for a long time, and isn't that the way the game is played?
Yeah, and it's also a prime example of the kind of hypocrisy we have. As you're intimating, certainly this has been going on almost since the beginning of time. I guess Washington and Jefferson mm-hmm. Were doing it. But the fact of the matter is that has been raised to an art by this administration that, you know, it just goes, it explodes that anybody would publish, that the New York Times would dare publish information that has been leaked to it by sources outside of the White House. But, of course, the White House is free to leak anything it wants, including what it borders, if it doesn't cross over the lines of criminality, in revealing the identity of a CIA undercover operative, and one who worked in the most sensitive division, which basically had to do with determining what potentially enemy nations were amassing weapons of mass destruction. And I'm talking, of course, about a plane, Valerie Plame.
Yeah. Touching on your third point, the jailing of reporters, why is this trial, I mean, why is this significant in this particular case?
Unless reporters can promise confidentiality to leakers, there will be no leakage, and government, whether we're talking local, state, federal, will be free to commit whatever misdeeds, crimes, if you want, that it wants, because nobody will dare become a whistleblower.
Yeah. Well, I guess it sounds like it's almost contradictory, though. The reporters maybe are being lazy by printing these leaks, but they should be able to take these leaks and not identify who's telling them.
Oh, I think they have to. I don't think there's any question there. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, a leak should be checked out. There, most newspapers, press organs, whether we're talking broadcast or print, have a policy of requiring at least a second-party confirmation. But absolutely, they should report anonymous leaks. Look, the only way you're going to get a leak is to keep it anonymous. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you keep commissions of criminal acts, what have you, from ever getting out to the public. And that's a big price to pay in a democracy.
Yeah. So, Dave, are reporters, especially Washington reporters, maybe way too close with the people that they're reporting on?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's a given. The whole social circuit where the people you're reporting on have invited you, you know, to a dinner at the mansion. And you go there because, hey, I've been invited. And you pay a price by getting too close and too chummy.
Our guest is Dave Berkman. He is former host of Wisconsin Public Radio's Media Talk. He is a retired UW-Milwaukee professor of mass communications, and he is our regular media commentator here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for him as we talk about the Scooter Libby trial and its implications for the media. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen and her guest talking about a recent report that finds nearly half of all young people are exposed to, either intentionally or otherwise, to internet pornography. And what that means, that's coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Dave Berkman, our resident media critic, about the media issues being raised by the perjury trial and obstruction of justice trial of former vice presidential aide Louis Scooter Libby. Well, we know today that NBC's Meet the Press host Tim Russert will be testifying, and with that, the prosecution expects to wrap up its case today against Louis Libby. Lots of dispute over who told what when, and we'll be hearing more about that from the trial today. I did last week, on the weekend, in fact, Dave Berkman, see the Fox News Watch program where Eric Burns hosts this, and then they have a number of liberal and conservative media commentators on it. And they're making kind of a big deal out of this trial, with Eric Burns saying that he doesn't know if this is going to be a landmark trial legally, but it will be journalistically. And they talked about what's going to happen as a result of the trial in terms of the relationship between journalists and government sources. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
We've ever had anything which in such a compact period of time reveals so much about the relationship between the press and power.
Yeah, so give us some examples from the Louis Libby situation.
Well, you've got, for the example I talked about earlier is probably the best one, with Judith Miller. She is co-opted, and then they set up this thing, making sure they leak it to her so that it makes the front page of the New York Times, and they so that they can say, hey, you want independent proof of what we're talking about? Check out the front page of this morning's New York Times. Well, it wasn't independent proof. It was a setup, and it was a brilliant setup. And most of that seems to have been orchestrated out of the Dick Cheney's office. By the way, an important development yesterday that's gotten relatively little attention. MSNBC's David Schuster has done a really good job of covering this on the Matthews and Oberman shows on MSNBC. Reported that they're now looking likely that Dick Cheney will not testify because he was supposed to be a defense, not a prosecution witness, and they're suddenly realizing if Cheney comes in there and speaks the truth, he will be more or less putting the screws in Libby's coffin.
Yeah, it's also Libby may not testify either, even though he originally it was thought he would.
Yeah, what has happened is you've now had six today with Russert reporters who have categorically and administration officials who have categorically showed that he was lying under oath, that he could not possibly have forgotten what he was told when he was told long before he spoke to Russert. And now the questions are, can he look credible trying to say, well, duh, I forgot.
Well, didn't he take really detailed notes, Louis Libby, about, you know, talk to Mary Madeline today?
Yeah, and some of that's coming back to bite him. I mean, that's just another reason why they don't want to have Fitzgerald standing there asking him questions. Well, didn't you write da-dum-da-dum-da-dum on this memo we see here?
Yeah. Well, we've got callers, so let me go to callers. Earl in Fox Point. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on. And I totally agree with the idea that the administration was using Judith Miller and that we need to find out about this sort of abuse of the press. But that seems to be in tension with your other point, that we need more shield laws. Because if we had more journalist shield laws, such that Judith Miller would never have to testify, we wouldn't know the full truth we're learning about Louis Libby. And in fact, if we didn't have a shield law, Libby might not have felt comfortable doing this sort of seedy anonymous leaking, knowing that Judith Miller could be forced to testify. So it seemed like shield laws would make this sort of situation more likely, not less likely. Isn't that right?
There are pros and cons, but I think the cons so outweigh the pros. And by the way, you still could have made a case here. Because remember, much of the most damning testimony has not come from journalists, but from those within the administration who have contradicted what Libby testified to before the grand jury. By the way, the tapes will be made public today that were played in court yesterday, the full 8 hours of testimony.
Yeah, the tapes of... you're not talking about Louis Libby's tapes that he...
Yes, the tapes of Libby's testimony will be available online today.
Okay.
And large excerpts will be played, especially on the cable news networks.
Let's thank you, Earl. Bob in DeForest. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I wanted to ask Dave whether he thought this, well, you mentioned about the fear factor and the social cocktail party circuit with the press and kind of knowing these lies and not reporting. Has there been a gradual erosion in journalistic integrity over the years, or is this just administration specific that we see this kind of problem with the press?
Well, the establishment has always tried to co-opt the press. I mean, with the exception of Murdoch papers, we no longer have the kind of purely political newspapers in which no separation between editorial pages and news content. This has kind of ebbed and flowed over the history of America, but it's gotten far worse under the Bush administration, which plays a kind of hardball that has been virtually unknown in American history.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob, for the call. Mike in Castle Rock is next. Hello, Mike.
Good morning. I've had a security clearance, and I'm just curious. Isn't it a violation of the law? And I don't see why the press should be exempt from what the government thinks is secure. Now, having said that, there's probably too much information that's deemed sensitive, and it's held and not released to the public. But what do you do with people that with the press that says that this is a secure story and it was leaked?
What you do is, if what they're leaking involves wrongdoing, you praise the leakers. And there is supposed to now be a whistleblowers act that prevents punishing those who expose wrongdoing, although I grant that that does not really fully apply to where there are allegations of security implications. But you say, why is the press exempt? For the same reason that the press is the only private enterprise that is specifically granted absolute freedom. Congress shall make no law in the Constitution of the United States. The press is different. It is precious. It is what makes democracy possible. Because without information that the press, and I'm talking about including all media, without the information we learn from these media, what we're going to be is simply find ourselves living in the kind of environment you lived in Saddam's Iraq, in Stalinist Russia, and Hitler Germany.
Thanks very much, Mike, for the call. We're talking with Dave Berkman. He is former host of Wisconsin Public Radio's Media Talk and a retired professor of mass communications at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking with him about the ongoing trial of Scooter Louis Libby, the former vice presidential aide, who's facing perjury and obstruction of justice charges in the case of leaking the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Valerie Plame, of course, married to former Ambassador Joe Wilson, a critic of the Bush administration. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you'd like to talk with Dave about the various press, media, journalistic implications of this particular trial. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. A number of press secrets are being spilled during the Scooter Libby trial, and a number of other issues are being raised, like leaking, government sources leaking to reporters, the jailing of reporters and reporter shield laws, talking about the working relationship between journalists and their sources, especially government sources, and also to what lengths government, in this particular case, the Bush administration, will go to punish critics. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We have an open line for you, and our next caller is Laura in Madison. Hi, Laura. Laura, are you there? I guess Laura's not there. She wanted to ask about the lack of investigative journalism going on. Dave, I'm sure you have some thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah. Investigative journalism was the hot thing 25 years ago. Is it 30 years ago now with Watergate? Because of the cost, because of the potentials of especially the potential costs of defending against libel cases, it's pretty much receded into the background. Remember, the most important trend in newspapering today, and this has been true for the past 2 or 3 years, is cutting back on working journalists. The newsrooms are being absolutely decimated, whether we're talking about your local small or medium town daily or the major papers like the Times, the Boston Globe, Washington Post, what have you, L.A. Times, Chicago Tribune, etc.
Yeah. Brian in Sorona is next. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. My question is, hello, Dave. I loved your show when it was on. I wish it was back on. But my question is, isn't there a taking away of the freedom of the press at this moment because of the way, the press has been, bought up by everybody, and, one news company is owned by one other, there's no longer a small-town newspaper. There's, these huge conglomerations. And then also along with that, doesn't the way the president handles the press corps kind of shut down that freedom of the press that, if there's a person that's critical of the president, he doesn't get called on, he's put in the back row of the press corps, stuff like that?
Well, with regard to the latter, more and more of the reporters sitting in the front row now are asking the questions which they might have avoided a few years ago. I think there's been a tendency to over-exaggerate the effect of this increasingly concentrated group over, ownership, although an awful lot of these conglomerates are now being split up with component parts being sold off. With the exception of the Murdoch-owned News Corporation and all of its Fox and related enterprises, I don't think, for example, you do not find the email to the CEO of General Electric calling Brian Williams every day and telling him what he can or cannot cover. The most left-wing mainstream journalism that we're seeing right now, anti-administration journalism, is playing on MSNBC with Keith Olbermann, who's become the hottest figure in broadcast journalism right now, and he's bringing in the sponsors because he is bringing in that younger advertiser desire demographic, whereas most cable news shows, pretty much cater to old bleeps like me.
This is going to shift us a little bit off topic, but I don't care. This is we can talk about more than just the Lewis Libby trial and journalism. But that just reminded me, Bill O'Reilly, the Keith Olbermann's nemesis on the Fox News Channel.
Or does he call him Bill O'Reilly?
Does he say that? he has started a campaign against NBC and MSNBC for being being almost anti-American in its coverage of the Iraq War issue. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, in fact, he posted a new screed on his own. That is O'Reilly's website. He posted a screed to that effect. Well, if you dare take issue with what the administration claims is its policies to defeat terrorism, you therefore are, by definition, as Bush stated back in 2001, you're with the enemy. You're pro-terrorist. And, you know, I mean, this whole idea of people sitting in corporate headquarters at GE and exchanging phone calls with bin Laden is, you know, it's just absurd.
Yeah, what really set him off, O'Reilly, was when NBC became, I believe, the first network to start referring to the war in Iraq as a civil war.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that wasn't the first thing. Oberman has, I think, very smartly, both in terms of the attention it earns him, but also because I think he's basically correct, started taking on O'Reilly at least 3 out of every 5 days. My estimate, because I'm a regular watcher of the show, O'Reilly makes the list of the worst persons in the world. So this has been going on for over a year now.
Yeah, and now he's on his latest kick, O'Reilly, that is a military analyst hired by NBC, and I wish I remembered his name, but I don't, but this claiming that this guy is not really a military analyst, that he's an anti-war peacenik.
Well, the most prominent analyst is Colonel, what the devil is his name, Jack, former Congressional Medal of Honor winner, I forget his last name. There may be others there, but it seems to be 90% of the time, and this goes across both the NBC broadcast news and the NBC cable news channels, he's the guy they bring in.
Yeah. We'll Cheryl is looking for his name. Yeah, it's William Arkin, but I don't know. There are some credentials he has. But
the name does not ring a bell, and I want to tell you, I watch 3 to 4 hours a day of MSNBC.
Yeah. Let's go to Tim in Sparta. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. A couple of things. Just real quick on that William Arkin thing. They classify him as a military analyst. However, when you look at his background, he's got all kinds of ties to, like, Greenpeace, MoveOn.org, and all kinds of stuff. So it's just kind of, at least that's what the piece that I got out of when I watched the O'Reilly Factor the other night and they were talking about it. That, that's what I got out of it.
He's on
my main point was, I believe it's important to talk about, you know, the situation with Scooter Libby and then have the press investigate it. However, I do believe there is a definite disconnect here with the liberal press. We're sitting here talking about Scooter Libby. How many shows have we had that we talked about Sandy Berger, who I feel did something a whole lot worse, where he stole classified documents and destroyed them? We don't talk about that.
Well, first of all, we did talk about it. Mm-hmm. He was the National Security Advisor. He brought stuff home. Nobody accused him of leaking any of it, selling it to the enemy, and I think it's a mountain out of a molehill. So you and I are going to disagree on whether there's any comparability between what the Cheney-led effort involving Libby to castigate Wilson and his wife and what Sandy Berger did. But believe me, that got a lot of press.
Yes, Tim, go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. Sandy Berger, how can you say that? He stuffed classified documents down his pants. He stuffed classified documents down his pants and snuck them out of the National Archives.
That's absolutely true.
It's illegal, and nobody does know what he stole out of there. It could have been anything, but it was right before.
Yeah. Tim, you know what? He's not on trial now.
And also, there's no
evidence. I know, but that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that we drop it, we don't talk about that, but then you get a guy connected to Bush, we just go show after show on it.
He should indict him.
I believe
he was indicted for stuffing it down its pants. It didn't go anywhere after he stuffed it down its pants. So the answer is this in no way comes close to approximating what has been revealed in the Cheney, Plame, Wilson, Scooter Libby affair. And who would have ever, I think this is the biggest revelation of all, who would have ever thought in the tough guy Bush administration that the tough guy Cheney's chief of staff would have an adorable nickname like Scooter.
and to be clear, Dave, Scooter is not accused of being the government official to first leak this information.
That is correct.
He was indicted on charges of lying, perjury, and obstruction of justice.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tim, I appreciate the call. You know, I'm going to follow up a little bit on this a liberal versus a conservative media issue, too, since that always comes up when we do programs like this. And I talked a couple of weeks ago, last month, with Tim Graham from the Media Research Center, a conservative media watchdog group, and we were talking about coverage of the war in Iraq and the president's call for this surge. And I'd like to get Dave's take on that after this break. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We started out the hour talking about the journalistic implications of the Lewis Libby trial going on right now in Washington. Prosecution expects to wrap up its case today with testimony from journalist Tim Russert. But we're expanding on that a little bit because frankly, some of you are calling about issues other than that. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll join Ben Marins, who's with you between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. This afternoon after 5 o'clock, well, looky here, Ben will be talking to NPR Talk of the Nation host Neil Conan. Neil Conan is going to be in Wisconsin this weekend for some events, and he'll talk to Ben a little bit about that, but mostly about how Talk of the Nation talks with the nation. That's coming up after 5. We're talking media with Dave Berkman this hour. Dave, former host of Wisconsin Public Radio's Media Talk and former professor of mass communications at UW-Milwaukee, our regular media critic and pundit. Talking with him first about the implications of the Scooter Libby trial going on in Washington, talking about all the various press connections and journalist implications going on with this trial. However, I'm broadening out our discussion a little bit to talk about the media in general and media coverage of the Bush administration in general, since that's what a lot of you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Let me get your take, Dave. Last month, instead of talking to you, I talked with Tim Graham from the Media Research Center about some complaining they were doing about press coverage of the new plan for Iraq, the new strategy to surge troops in Iraq, saying that the media was not giving this a chance, that this whole idea was defeated before it left the president's lips, because the media is just not gonna let this happen. You want to talk about whether media coverage on the war in Iraq is decidedly tilted to the left now?
Well, you have an administration which has been making claims going back to the immediate aftermath of 9/11, every one of which has proven to be either untrue as fact or simply never came to pass as a prediction. And there's a rather consistent record here. And the fact is, that record now, it seems to me, gives the responsible media not the right, but the obligation to point up, hey, these guys keep screwing up. We have good reason to believe they're going to screw up again. So I obviously have no problem with it.
Yeah. You touched on it earlier. While the media press, New York Times maybe in particular, was not questioning the Bush administration very hard when it came to the war in Iraq.
In the news pages, it was on the op-ed pages, especially Krugman and Dowd.
Yeah. But the tide has shifted. You believe
sure.
That?
Sure. And I mean, the Times published this big apologia after it did an internal investigation. Yeah, we blew it.
Yeah.
And they got rid of Judith Miller, although they gave her seven-figure settlement in doing so.
Yeah. Let's take Mary in Madison next. Hello, Mary.
Hi, yes. I'm always concerned when I hear people talking about the liberal media, and I just feel that this is something that has been, especially in this administration, propagated that the media is liberal, it's against us. I think if you look at the corporate ownership of a lot of the media outlets today and what actually is being done and said, that media is if anything, biased on a liberal slant. I wonder if he could address that issue for us.
Yeah, the most subversive programming on broadcasting today are the coupling of John Stewart and the Colbert Report, and that's owned by the massive CBS Viacom conglomerate. You've got Keith Olbermann emerging as the hottest figure in broadcast journalism on a network owned by General Electric, perhaps one of the most reactionary corporations in American history. Fox Sunday Night, the comedy schedule. This is the same Fox that, you know, which puts on the Fox News cable channel, but on its broadcast channel, it presents 2 hours of the most subversive anti-administration programming with the cartoon block that he does, especially American Dad and Family Guy, simply because those attract audience. And whatever are Rupert Murdoch's ideological concerns, as dear as they are to him, they are never as dear as what brings in the most profit. So while we have to be concerned about that control, and it is beginning to break up, the big trend now among big media is to divest of elements. And I think the left has kind of used that as a bromide.
Thank you, Mary. Charles in Kakana is with us now. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. I don't know if you can hear me okay.
Yes, I can. Go ahead. You can turn your radio off, though. That'll be better.
I got it. I had a point, and then your previous guest brought, or your previous caller brought something else to mind. But I think it would be good to if Dave could do a study on the effects of corporate ownership and how many editors and how many journalists are actually leaving these publications for that reason, if they're actually seeing interference with their work. And then the other thing, there's. Seems to be, since you kind of opened it up to media in general, and my point was that there seems to be a real interest in the Libby story, but I think Judith, what's her name, Valerie Plame, was actually out of the field for 7 years or something before this leak took place, and so I'm wondering, that's just another quick question you can answer, but then my final point was, to follow up on that.
No, let's Charlie, I'm sorry. Got a number of questions here. I want to not forget them all. It doesn't matter that Valerie Plame supposedly was not a undercover agent at the time of the leak, though I think there's some dispute over that, Dave.
I don't think there's any more dispute over that. I think that was part of some of the game playing that was going on to raise doubts about that. It is against the law. This is a follow-up following what happened with, what was his name, Philip Agee, when he revealed the names of CIA undercover agents, one of whom was allegedly killed in Greece. As a result of that, it becomes a crime to reveal that. And the idea that you or I could be sent up the river for life or whatever for doing that, but Dick Cheney can't be, it seems to me to be absolutely absurd. The fact is, the woman was an undercover agent in the most sensitive, probably, work that the CIA does, trying to ascertain what weaponry is available to America's potential enemies. And for her to have been exposed, and for her talents and that 7 years of experience no longer to be exploited, seems to me, just is perhaps the best example giving the lie to all the sanctimonious concerns of the Bush administration.
Final question, Joy?
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing, you mentioned the media with the coverage of the Libby trial, and you mentioned the fear factor that they reported things because they were operating out of fear. But there's a case that it's got novel-like perspective, novel-like possibilities, and that's the Sandy Berger case, but nobody in the media seems interested at all in touching that, and it's got far-reaching implications that the media just doesn't seem interested in, and I'm wondering what sort of fear they'd be operating under by pursuing that story. It certainly probably wouldn't come from the Bush administration.
Well, this is the second time we've touched on that, and I'll basically repeat what I said earlier. It does not come up to that level. I mean, this whole image of Sandy Berger opening his pants and stuffing stuff down, and maybe he needed a diaper like that astronaut lady, I don't know. But it simply does not approach the significance and the seriousness of what happened with this thing. And yes, it was widely reported. He did plead guilty for something. He was indicted. He did not. He reached a plea bargain. But it doesn't, to claim that that in somehow approaches in seriousness what we've seen with the plane thing is on its face a patent absurdity.
Thanks, Charlie, or Art, or Todd, or Philip. Charlie in Mequon is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, two Charlies in a row. That's pretty good.
No, the other one really wasn't Charlie, but go ahead.
Well, one thing that I wanted to touch on, and I guess it's back on the plate again, is the burger thing. And I just wanted to say that, you know, we have to be really clear as to what we're focusing on. You know, it's not about necessarily this Scooter Libby thing as much as it's about what the administration used in order to squelch opposition or keep people from talking out. What Sandy Berger did was take something. I guess if people really wanted to think about it, what George Bush has been doing with his security NSA spying plan is taking volumes and volumes and volumes of private information and stuffing it in his virtual trousers.
Right, so, and you know, where the analogy breaks down is Berger never leaked anything. Cheney's office leaked the identity of an undercover CIA agent.
Right,
to claim
that's
these things
the
are
point.
Comparable is patently absurd.
Right, and that's the point that people have to keep in mind. We keep diverging off the issue to try and find likes in some oblique angle, but the bottom line is the whole reason we're talking about this is a treasonable offense, and that is exposing an operative. Now, we're jumbled up in the legal stuff of trying to say it's Scooter Libby indicted for some little, you know, piece of the puzzle, but the bottom line is we're trying to get to the source of this, which is, did the Bush administration leak a name in order to silence a critic of their policy or their agenda?
Unfortunately, Fitzgerald chose not to go in that direction, and he's come
I don't
under,
understand.
Yeah, he's come under criticism
that.
For this. He allowed, for example, the vice president to testify not under oath, as some a former prosecutor was anonymously quoted on a couple of newscasts yesterday, said if he had been in charge of this case, he would have insisted that Cheney, when he was questioned, do so under oath, and he would have then that would have led to his being included as an unindicted co-conspirator.
I agree with you. May I just bring one point to just add a little tangent to it, because it's perfectly aligned to what you just said, and that is this whole bit about the media not necessarily making a big deal about the word non-binding. We're doing a whole lot of reporting about things that really pacify a liberal side, or I wouldn't even say liberal side. It seems to be the overwhelming majority of the American public as voted in November. But what we're doing is we're covering things that say we're getting tough, but then we use a word like non-aligned or non-binding, and all of a sudden, you know, people don't comprehend that that means that whatever they say really doesn't matter. I mean, we can be as tough as we want, but we're not going to do anything about it. And when we do things like not letting people swear under oath, we're saying you can say anything you want, because even if you you purge yourself, you're still free.
Well,
I
think we're mixing up another number of things here, but you'd said a little bit earlier that you didn't think the non-binding, the absurdity of a non-binding, putting significance on a non-binding resolution was getting attention. Let me tell you, the last week that has been getting a lot of attention across the media, and I think this is one of the few things we can't fault the media for having given up its responsibility. The absurdity of a the significance of a non-binding resolution is getting a very great attention.
Thanks to Charlie. And Mark in Richland Center is with us now. Hi.
Good morning. So with the lack of focus on what's really gone wrong here, do you really think that even with the note in the vice president's handwriting that according to the press we were supposed they were going after Valerie Plame. Do you think that the American people will eventually hold these guys accountable in a criminal court, or do you think that they'll be let off? Hell, Nixon was brought to task for activity much less serious than this. Do you think that we'll finally get to a place of prosecution on these guys?
Probably not prosecution, but as far as what the public comes away with, they'll now have an idea that the administration does do dirty things, but if you think people are following the implications of what Matt Cooper said as opposed to what Judith Miller said or what have you, no, that's for junkies like you and me. But most folks are at best going to come away with a vague understanding. Another example of a guy whose rating popularity rating stands at 20%, Dick Cheney. Another example of the kind of sleaze that he engages in.
Got an email from somebody who forgot to leave their name. I'm just curious about whether everyone has simply forgotten about Dick Armitage's tearful confession on 2020 about being the source of the leak. Very dramatic, but no one seems to mention that anymore. Why not?
For a very simple reason. It wasn't significant in what happened. We now know that within a day, in fact, on the very day that the thing was published, there's a directive seemed to be coming down directly from Dick Cheney himself that this lady is to be exposed. Now that there was a parallel revelation of that by Armitage, simply because Armitage is a guy whose reputation is he loves to gossip, I don't think these are comparable.
Yeah.
Or has any significance.
We are almost out of time, but time for Mary in Milwaukee, if it's brief. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I'm just calling something off the media, I guess. There's been a lot of talk about the cozy relationship between the media and the Bush administration, but to me what's most interesting about this case is that it proves that during the build-up to the war, what Bush and Cheney were most interested in was not finding the evidence that there were WMDs or that the threat was imminent. What they were interested in was squashing the people who were saying the opposite, but squashing the people who were disagreeing with them on these issues.
Yeah, thank
you. That's a perfect summary of what we've been talking about the past hour.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Well, Dave, any final thoughts in our last 30 seconds on this trial?
I'm absolutely transfixed by it, but I'm not sure how typical that is of most of America.
You're transfixed because you do want you're waiting for the outcome here.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot for being with us. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Dave Berkman, Wisconsin Public Radio's resident media critic, former host of Media Talk, a retired professor of mass communication at UW-Milwaukee, talking with us about the various press implications, media implications of the trial of Louis Libby. Today, Tim Russert will be testifying as the prosecution wraps up its case. And we'll hear more about that in the news. Thanks very much to Karen Prager for producing this hour and to Cheryl Gasser for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.